Welcome to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Hey, good evening and welcome to Breaking the Silence. I'm Greg Williams. Welcome to my home here in the most awesome city in the world, Houston, Texas. I just love this town, love this city, not just because of all the food that is excellent here, but just because of the people, just because of the opportunities, just because of everything that you have the access to. Right across the street is where the Texans play, right down the road is where the Astros play. Right behind me is the Texas Medical Center, which is the best medical center in the absolute world with all the best hospitals I'm proud to be part of. And it's just a great, great, great community. If you've never been to Houston, I invite you to come on down because this is a place that once you get here, you go, why didn't I get here sooner? I love Texas. And got to do a lot of things in Texas this week are just an awesome, awesome week. We want to welcome you to the program, and you can get involved several different ways, just like each and every week. If you want to call right in to Don or Doug or TJ at the BBS radio station, feel free to use your best radio voice and dial 888-627-6008, and they will answer the phone, BBS radio, and they will patch you right on through with your comment or your question that you have for our guest tonight. And we will batter it around and beat it up and kick it right back to you and let you stay online live on the radio around the world with us as we answer it or you have a comment. We would love to hear from you. Or you can get on Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page that ought to be up live and running right now. My son, Curtis, my youngest son, is in the United States Army, and he is running that from the base in Seattle, Washington. So you can get on there and comment, and he will text me or let me know if there's any comments or questions. Or you can just do it the old-fashioned way. The old-fashioned way nowadays is just text me at 832-396-6525. And during our commercial break, I will check it to make sure there's not a question or a thought or a comment. I'll be glad to patch that through to our guests this evening. Before we have our guests come on, I always like to start off with each week indicating something that maybe I have learned through life's experience. Our guest tonight is a teacher, so don't let that scare you. He's a friendly teacher. Sometimes teachers intimidated me, but I thought I always did pretty well with it. But most of the time, I'd like to just share with you maybe something that I learned in the week that I thought maybe you would be able to jump in and get some thoughts on it too and write it down. And maybe I'll help you in the middle part of next week as you go, oh, wow, I remember hearing that. And I think that we would have so many less problems in our life if we would just learn to stop denying that we have problems to begin with. I think there's so many people that has a mindset as a doctrine in life to just deny that they have problems at all. Matter of fact, in my second book, When Dark Clouds Come, the second chapter is entitled I'm Fine and Neither Are You. And I think that's what sometimes we need to be able to realize in life, that when somebody says, hey, how you doing? And you just deny what you're going through, go, hey, I'm fine. That basically is a red flag saying either something wrong, I'm enduring something, or I'm just barely making it, or I'm doing the best I deserve. I use that line all the time. And I think a lot of times that we just need to realize that if we deny the problems in our life, that necessarily, and I absolutely, doesn't cause them to go away. It usually makes the problem worse. So how can you fix something if you don't know or admit that it's even wrong? And amazingly, in some environments, you're not allowed to have problems. I want to tell you what, in my life in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, since I kind of broke through and broke out of that closet that I was in of me being abused, and I didn't want anybody to know about it. It's just a secret that I'm going to keep myself. And I promise that I will never bring it up, never talk about it, and it'll just eventually go away. And it doesn't work that way. That problem ends up churning in the inside of you. It ends up eating away at whatever cell in your body is good that's left to eat away at. And because of that, I have so many things wrong with my body physically and probably mentally, but I don't want to go there. Just because I denied that I ever had problems to begin with. And I think one of the most freeing things that I ever was involved with in my life was after my mom died, and I decided to tell everybody exactly what happened to me. And even in the first book that tells about my life story, I didn't tell everything. I left out about half of it. And I'm kind of working on, even though I speak about it all around the country all the time, about what happened to me during my young teenage years. I really kind of was afraid to go into that much depth into my life, but it's so freeing to know that I'm standing in front of a group of people, or I'm on a radio station like this, and just sharing that I went through hell and back, but it didn't burn me up. That I made sure that I didn't stop while I was in there, that who was Winston Churchill, if you're going through hell, keep on going. As I was traveling through it, just don't stop. You just want to keep on moving. And sharing that with one trusted friend was huge. But then telling more and more and more people about it became to be more freeing for me, became more liberating. Those weights started to fall off me. And I think the most freest person in the world today is one that has nothing to hide. Hey, this is me. If you don't like me, fine. But I'm not changing or adapting my road just so you'll feel better about who I am. I am telling you this is who I am. This is what I went through. And I'm not ashamed of what I went through. And I'm not for sure I would change everything, because what I went through made me who I am today. And I kind of like who I am today, but it took a long time to get me there, because I keep playing through my mind all those things that my dad told me when I was a kid. You'll never amount to nothing. You're never going to be good enough. You're never going to be smart enough. You're going to have to hang around here for the rest of your life because you don't have what it takes to be out in the real world. And I tell you what, being able to overcome that, free that up, was so liberating for me. So just denying the facts don't make them go away. Saying something is super good when in truth it's super bad is simply telling a super lie. And you don't need to do that to yourself. Be bold enough to pull yourself up by your britches, pull up your boots by the bootstraps, and pick yourself up and go, hey, this is what the world's handed me. And I'm going to take it. I'm going to rewrap it. And I'm going to present it back and give it to the world double fold. And they're going to wish that they never treated me the way they did, because I'm going to make them pay for it in the long run. So walking by faith is not the way to walk. You need to walk by faith, not fake. Fake never works, and faith never ceases to work. So sometimes you can tell more about a person by what they hide than by what they show. So just take a second right now and go, hey, wait, is he talking to me? Is this about me? Who am I pretending to be when everybody around me probably knows better? What are we hiding from that is keeping you off center from the very purpose that you were designed for? Because if you take all that stuff and put a positive tendency on it, a positive coat of paint on it, and point it in the positive direction, it can help change people's lives. And when it comes to changing people's lives, who's better in this world that's with our kids more than anybody during their formative years than a teacher? So I'm kind of glad I have a teacher, a retired teacher, on tonight. And I kind of want to take his take on that. When do you understand that we need to come to reality that we went through some things, that we're dealing with some things, that I have issues right now? So we need to talk to each other, share with somebody that you can trust, because in all reality, most people probably knows what's going on, or at least feel that something's going on that's not right. So next time somebody says, hey, how you doing? And they really care, don't say, I'm just fine. So tell you what, you got a minute? Let's grab a cup of coffee and let's talk. And it may be the greatest, most liberating thing you've ever done. All right. That's all I got for you. Free of charge. That didn't cost you a doggone dollar. I want to welcome to the program tonight a special guest with us, Wesley Moore, not the first, not the second, but Wesley Moore the third. And he is from South Carolina. And he taught English at the Porter Gould School in Charleston for 34 years before he retired about 5 years ago. And I want to bring him in because every time I see Wesley, I think of it. I want to bring you in first. So, Wesley, good evening. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Greg, how are you doing?
Doing great. I feel like I have just come into Jimmy Buffett's home, and I am talking now to Jimmy Buffett with your hat. And every picture that I ever found of you, you have a hat like that on. So is this just you, huh?
Well, it's cheaper than a toupee.
I like the way you think. That's good. That's good. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
It's good to have you. You live there in South Carolina?
Yeah, I live on a little island called Folly Beach, South Carolina.
That's why all the pictures are there in the little gazebos and the tiki huts and all of that. Okay, so you live on a little island of South Carolina.
Yeah, it's right off, it's about 20 miles from Charleston.
Okay, and in that, I know that's probably not where you taught. That's just where you retreated after retirement?
Well, I've lived here 25 years. I used to be a surfer. And before that, I lived on the Isle of Palms, another barrier island. But when my kids got into middle school, we moved to Folly Beach, which is a little bit funkier than the Isle of Palms. The Isle of Palms had soccer and sidewalks and after-school programs, and Folly's a little bit funkier than that.
Yeah. And what grades did you teach, Wesley, when you were teaching?
Ninth through 12th. My last couple of years, I taught ninth grade English, 10th grade British Lit, and a senior course in the history of the 1960s. But I also taught AP Lit and American Lit. So over the course of 34 years, I taught about every course they had in English.
So in this senior course that was about the 1960s, is that where somewhere down the line the seed of the book Today, Oh Boy, was planted? That maybe those...
No, I actually wrote the book before I retired. And I tried to get an agent and couldn't get an agent. And my wife became ill, and so I've more or less put it down. And I've started dating a an editor, a professional editor who's worked at Forbes Publishing. And I showed her the first chapter, and she said, "Wow, this is about 80% there, but it needs some work." And so she helped me edit it. And then the second place I sent it, it got accepted. So
Wow.
here
But
it
the way
is.
you write, there it is today, oh boy. And we'll talk about the cover shortly because that's a beautiful cover.
Thank you.
Unbelievable cover. When you teach English like you did, was the way you write automatically part of who you are? Because boy, when you describe something, you literally draw it in my mind. From the young girl's hair that draped all the way down, the color of it, the way she shampooed her hair, just so many different ways. Was that all in you, or is that something you had to learn how to artistically divulge as you went along?
Well, you acquire those skills through reading. Reading, reading, reading. And to be an excellent writer, you have to read a lot. I
Yeah.
learned a lot from Ernest Hemingway
Oh.
because Hemingway was one of the first cinematic novelists. The movies had come out, and so he would describe things, you could really see them. And I wrote the novel in present tense, and I switched from scenes to scenes pretty rapidly. So it's almost like a novelistic movie. That's not to say it's not literary, because it is. There are motifs, symbolism, but my main objective is to entertain the reader and to bring a world alive for the reader.
Yeah. Well, is there anything in the book, Wesley, that is could be known as autobiography in your own life? Did you say, hey, wait, I went through that experience. I know what it felt like. I know what it looked like. It smelled like, and I want to write about it and incorporate it. Did you do any of that in this novel writing?
Well, almost everything that happens is fictitious, but the novel is based on people I knew, and the characters are sort of amalgams of people I knew. The only thing in the novel that actually really happened to me, one time I was dismissed from school because my hair was too long, and I'd ridden the school bus to school, so I had to hitchhike to a barber shop, get my hair cut, and hitchhike back to school. But that's the only incident in the novel that actually happened. When I was teaching at Porter Gaud, we had a water main break, and the entire school had to be dismissed. And something like that happens. And today, oh boy, when a chemistry experiment goes bad, the entire school has to be dismissed. But otherwise, everything's fictitious. Though I will
Yeah.
admit, I used to have red hair like Rusty Boykin, and Rusty was my high school nickname. But he's really
Yeah.
me exactly.
Well, that's neat because I remember reading that part about the book where the collar length of the hair was too long and you had to
Yeah.
get a haircut and hitchhike and all that. That's good. That's good. What ended up, was writing a book one of those things that you always had in you that you always dreamed about, or was it something that just kind of popped up?
No, I've been writing since the fourth grade. I won the Somerville High School Writing Award, and in my first marriage to Judy Birdsong, my late wife, that I was writing short fiction and poetry and getting it published. But we had a baby, and Judy was the head of a psychology department at a 2-year college, and she desperately wanted to stay home with Harrison, our first son, and there's no way I could support a family publishing short stories. So I luckily got a job teaching at Porter Gaud, and it's a great thing that happened to me. I really, really loved it. I spent 34 years just loving what I was doing, and so I feel very fortunate.
Yeah. That is the book One complete day at school.
It's actually 8 hours. It starts in homeroom and ends about 5 o'clock. And you go through the school day experiencing different classes. There are lots and lots of characters. And I think that's what drives the novel. Kirkus Reviews gave it a spectacular review, and it said, "Dazzling characters front this quietly sublime period piece." And this month I'm featured in Kirkus Reviews print edition in a short interview for Indie Writers. And
That's great.
if your listeners and viewers would go to the Kirkus, KIRKUS website, type in Wesley Moore, and the review will come up, and it gives a very effective synopsis of the action of the novel.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, one of the things that, I mean, it seemed like, of course, I went to school in the late 60s, early 70s. And I remember the bell. I mean, just the way you did the ring at each chapter, and it just brought back some memories of mine, good and bad. But it made me think of things that I forgot all about that, or I forgot what that was like. And it to me, it was almost it was nice to have that trip back, even though, I'm not for sure that's what you were after, but that's what I really enjoyed about it, besides the characters, was how it made me remember kids in my own classroom that I had forgot even existed.
One of the motifs, one of the recurring themes of Today, Oh Boy, is sort of confinement. Sandy describes it as Alcatraz one time when she picks Rusty up hitchhiking, and those bells are just a reminder that how regimented your life is in a school situation. At PortaGaud, we quit having bells, which was nice. Over the years, we would just we'd look up at the clock and say, "Okay, it's time to go," or you could hear people in the halls, but the bells were really loud before that, and I wanted to underscore that confinement
Yeah,
motif.
you did that great, because I think now they may have a buzzer or something, but that bell was like the fire was taking off, like, and it just kept going, like, okay, we got it, we got it. What did you learn by looking all those years and dealing and working and slinging sweat and teaching with all these different ages, 3.5 decades? What happened during those decades that you thought was something maybe you would have never seen when you was teaching in the 80s? Let's see, would you be teaching in the 80s?
Yeah, I started in 85. That was my first.
Teaching in the 80s compared to when you were teaching in 2015. Major difference in that.
The children in the mid-80s were more worldly. This might seem counterintuitive to you, but they were more adult-like, and they were more like adults. And in 2019, when I retired, they were much more childlike. They're actually nicer than they used to be. And adolescence is a weird, weird time in one's life when simultaneously you think you're the center of the universe, yet you don't count. And so you have this paradoxical contradiction. And you can see this in the novel. The kids think other people are looking at them, and no one's looking at them. They're busy thinking about themselves, not other people. And so I essentially learned that kids are kids, and I loved them. PortaGaud is a very it's an independent school. It's been around since 1867. It started as a orphanage school for right after the Civil War, and the clientele's very well heeled. In fact, Stephen Colbert, the late night host, is a graduate of PortaGaud School. But the school, but the kids themselves, they're just, I just love them. And they're, I can't stress that enough how much I admire the, those kids. And I learned a whole lot from them.
Is the problems any different today, or is it just the fact that we know more about what's going on in the schools than what we used to?
Well, the parents are much more involved than they were in 1985. And with social media and screens and emails, like in 1985, if a parent were upset with me, she would have to call my house on a telephone and then I'd talk to her. And people are less inclined to do that than they are to send you an email or a text. So the parents became much more involved with school than they used to be.
When you see the difference in the decades, do you notice that the problems, because we have these huge headlines all over the newspapers today, all the bullying and all those things. There was bullying back in the 60s.
Oh,
Matter of
God.
fact, it seemed like teachers were some of the kids in my own class were bullied by the teachers. PE teacher was the most hateful man ever, and he always made fun of the larger kids or the ones that couldn't run. And it's like the bullying came from the adults more than it did the kids. But there was bullying all the way back in those days, plus well beyond that.
Yeah, I had a PE coach like that. We had an overweight boy in the class, and he would always be making fun of him. But when I was teaching, I had this the number one rule of my class I called the Bodhisattva ideal, out of the Buddhist concept of the Bodhisattva. And you could not do anything whatsoever to hurt anyone's feelings. You weren't even allowed to roll your eyes. And I had the students read this contract and sign it, that they would adhere to the Bodhisattva ideal. And in the rare occasions when people disobeyed, I would just simply take them into the hall so no one else could see them and explain to them that they'd violated this rule and I didn't want that to happen anymore. So, to have an English class, literature discussions, people have to be free to be able to express themselves without the fear of being bullied verbally or being mocked or made fun of.
I've been thinking English because you want them to be able to share what's on their mind, their heart, their
Yes.
emotions. And I can see that being really, really important in English.
Yeah, and literature is a superb way, if it's literary, if it's real to life, is a wonderful way for children or anyone to achieve vicarious experience. Like Old Yeller, remember that movie?
Oh,
Old
yeah.
Yeller. You got, even if you had not experienced the death of a beloved pet, you vicariously experienced it through watching that film. And it's the same with literature. And it's a wonderful way to acquire experience without having to suffer it firsthand, because one day you are going to suffer.
I remember seeing Old Yeller. Right now, I can tell you exactly the movie theater I saw it at, where I was sitting when I saw it, what row I was sitting in, and what I felt like when that dog got shot. It's like, oh my land. I mean, it made you feel. I didn't even have a dog, but
Right.
you felt that. And literature has that amazing ability to be able to grab a person's mind and take them into a world and let them live that with them. And there's not too many things that can do that.
No, it's really it, and but the literature has to be, I'm calling it literary because a lot of like just pulp literature, all they all have happy endings, and life doesn't have happy endings. No matter how much integrity you had, no matter how much you were loved, that the end of your life is going to be a sad event.
Yeah,
So,
you're right. And because that doesn't sell books, but
right.
I think that true transparency and a way of dealing with that and revealing it and giving total reality would, if it's done right.
Yes.
Yeah. We're going to take our commercial break. 888-627-6008. If you want to call and you have a question for Wesley or myself or a comment, feel free to call in and we'll be right back. And on the other side of this break, I really want to find out about all the different topics. So if somebody buys this book tonight on Amazon, all the different topics that you cover and why you decided to cover this, and this, and get some insight about of the bullying, the racism, Vietnam, things of that order. And we're going to talk about that right on the other side of this break. Don't leave us. We'll be back in about a minute and a half. See you in a minute.
From HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back. We have our author, retired teacher, Wesley Moore III, and he is the author of Today, Oh Boy. And I want you to see the cover of this book, and you can get it right now at any bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, any place that sells good books will have that one, and there it is. And tell me about the cover a little bit, and we're going to get back into that. Who came up with the cover? Because that's a noted artist, is it not?
Yeah, it's David Boatwright, who's a muralist in Charleston. And even though my publisher would have supplied a novel, my wife, Caroline, said, you know, we ought to ask David if he'd be interested in creating a cover. And so I asked him, and he said, yeah, he'd be happy to. What he would do is create a painting, and that he would sell the painting and not charge me anything for the cover. So he read the novel and manuscript, and then created the cover. So on it, you see, there's Rusty Boykin, the red Mustang involved in the high-speed chase, Sandy Welch, and the Basset Hound, Mr. Peabody. And so that's sort of like a frozen montage of the book, and it really captures the low country of South Carolina, the trees, the moss dripping. And so
even the license plate says, oh boy, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And who didn't remember that kind of Mustang? Are you kidding me? The Ford Mustang, unbelievable. That was the car to have. You were in those days, I'll tell you what. How about the different topics that you hit on, from suicide? I mean, you hit a lot. If this is only one day in the life of a school, you hit almost all the ones that are pretty major. Why did you choose the ones that you did? And was there a reason for that? And which one did you want to do, but you walked away from that?
Well, it's the title Today, Oh Boy, comes from the Beatles song, A Day in the Life. And it,
yeah.
And the lyric is, I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was sad, I just had to laugh. So the novel, the biggest event of the novel happens before it starts. A student named Trip Trotter has fallen or jumped off a bridge. It's not clear at the beginning. And probably most readers think this novel is going to be unraveling that mystery, but it's actually what Alfred Hitchcock called a MacGuffin. It's something that, like the Maltese Falcon, is something that's actually not central to the novel at all. So it is a suicide, as it turns out. And high school students are so impulsive. They don't think. They think that they don't have enough experience to realize that, life goes on, that every girlfriend's heartbreak, and they don't have the perspective. So I wanted to put that to begin to get the action rolling. And then I also wanted to portray a school day from various classes and from various people's perspectives, and to introduce the idea of sort of existentialism, that these students are creating their world through their perceptions. I'll give you an example. Mrs. Laban, whom Rusty doesn't like and is afraid of, is actually, if you step outside of his mind, an excellent teacher, very dedicated, works really hard. And the impoverished girl who lives in the school bus, Camille Krill, Mrs. Laban is her favorite teacher, Rusty's least favorite teacher. And so I wanted to demonstrate, have a medley of different consciousnesses perceiving the same venue in different ways. I also wanted to highlight teaching itself, good teachers and bad teachers. And I like to, when I create characters, I want them to have depth, and I want to add little details to their lives. And I try to make every one of them sympathetic in a way. Even Bobby Beausheen, who's violent and sadistic, he suffered horrible childhood abuse that flashes back, which has sort of warped his personality. But ultimately, I don't really think he's a bad person, that he's just had an unfortunate upbringing. So I try to create sympathetic characters, and I wanted to go through a school day in a regimented way till you have the accident in the chemistry lab, then boom, everyone's free. There are no bells ringing. People are
Right.
all around town, and then the action really picks up.
I was reading the book. It ran through my mind. I don't even know if anybody's ever paired the two, but there's a movie called Stand By Me, with the three boys that spend one day in the whole movie is about one day in the summer where they go to see a dead body of the boy that gets hit by a train. Remember that movie?
Yeah, Stephen King.
It flashed me back to that movie because the characters were also had so much depth to them, and they would be considered almost in some ways bullies and bad guys. But then, like you just said, the one had gone through so much abuse as a child. There was a reason that they were the way they were, and it had so much depth.
Yeah, well, thank you. And people have also compared to Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Now, I noticed one of the reviews had Ferris Bueller meets Ulysses, which is a great illustration of what the book kind of is about.
Well, I sort of got the idea from I listened to Ulysses on 40 compact disc after I'd read it one time, and he creates such a marvelous world of Dublin in one day in 1906. I said, I'm no James Joyce, but I would like to try this in a much smaller scale without the stream of consciousness that no one can understand. And so that was sort of my inspiration.
Yeah, it was good. What about Vietnam? How did the book address it and the pros and cons of what students were going through in those days?
The Vietnam was, I graduated in 1971, and I had what my aunt was only 6 years older than I was, and one of her best friends was killed in Vietnam, was drafted and killed. And so it was always in the back of our minds because we could get drafted and go to Vietnam. And that's, and on Moratorium Day in 1969, about four or five students wore black armbands the school to protest the war, and were suspended from school. And so the times were tumultuous, obviously. You remember, you were there. And so Vietnam is in the back of everyone's mind. I don't know if you had a lottery number.
Yes, I did not myself personally, but yeah.
But when the lottery numbers came out, I was at my college introduction, and it wasn't printed in the newspaper. And I got the newspaper out of the newspaper stand and went looking for my birthday, and it was 278, and it went, yes, yes. And if your number was like 15 or 30, it was, you were going. There's also, my school had not been integrated fully in 1970, believe it or not. Even though Brown versus Board of Education was 1954, at Somerville High, we had a few black students, but they'd been hand-picked, almost like Jackie Robinson, the ball player. Students who were talented and thick-skinned, who could take a certain amount of abuse. So you had integration coming. Also in Somerville, you had people from the north moving in large numbers. The Somerville's population in 1970 was 3,500. It's 57,000 today. And so the town itself was undergoing a metamorphosis, an adolescence, if you will, the beginning of it. And then you have a lot of economic diversity. You have these country boys who are not college prep. You have a business part of the school with Camille Krill. She's taking home ec and typing and stuff. You had college prep. So you had a lot of different people coming together, and the old status quo of sort of quiet town was being upset. And I wanted to capture that as well, to make it stand out from a typical high school drama.
Did you second guess any time while you were typing some of the racism topic? Because when I saw one of the words, and I like the way you write different words, because it's like the way they sound when they said it instead of spelling it out exactly right. Which to me it was more entertaining that way. But did you ever go, oh, I don't know if I want to stick my toe in this or not? Or
yeah,
did you, because it was an issue, and it is an issue. But back in those days, it was a major issue. I mean, it is now, but I mean, it was.
Yeah, you know, we did a great job of, I have a friend named Warren Moise, who's a lawyer, and he's also a writer, and he wrote this really, really good book called The Class of 71, about the integration of his high school, which, you know, they left school in the spring, and then over the summer they decide to fully integrate it without any warning. And so their transition wasn't nearly as smooth as Somerville. But we did a great job. We got along together. Athletics helped a lot, having these stellar black athletes join the team. And so I was very happy. I mean, it wasn't all that tumultuous, but there is a little scene of racism that you see with Kevin Manigo, who is one of these handpicked talented kids, when they have the conflagration and the chemistry and they're dismissing school. Students with cars are going to the parking lot and the rest are going to the cafetorium with the buses, and he's going out to his car, and a teacher says, where do you think you're going? He's going, I'm going to the parking lot. You have a car? Like, she couldn't conceive that because he's black that he'd have his own automobile. So there's racism, Vietnam, and then the sort of culture clash of the farm boys and the hippies. So you have a conflict going on.
At the end of the day, Wesley, after you got this so beautifully done and published, and the cover and everything just the way you wanted it, how long did it take you, number one, to get that from beginning to end? That's a process, right?
Yeah, it's a long process and frustrating process. Well, you published
Yeah.
books, but it was accepted in, I think, January of, January of like 2021 and published in March of 2023.
Yeah.
And so we went through the editing process, and it was, and of
Was
course,
that painful for you?
no, not really. The editors, the publishing company, Austin Macaulay, is based in London, and they have offices in New York and I think in Sydney, Australia. And I think the people who were editing my book were British. And like I sometimes felt, to capture the dialect of the characters. But once they understood, they didn't mess with any of the content. They just had
Yeah, I
permission.
tell you, I had a fit with mine because they would throw words in there. Let's change this word to that word. So I would never have used that word. I don't even know what that word means, let
Right.
alone use it in my speech. I don't want that word. Well, we need to do this because it makes no. And I was every word. It was a battle, and it took forever. But when your book was finally finished, finally packaged, it did it, and you presented it to the world. What do you want that book to do for the people that pick it up, that buy it tonight, that read it over the week? What do you want them to do? Just be entertained? Or you want them to lean into something, learn something? What is the overall purpose and thought process of what you want them to come with after they finish reading your book?
Well, of course, I want them to be entertained, and I
Sure.
want them to realize that they have purchased something that's well crafted, that's something that's, this sounds pretentious, but it's artful, it's well constructed. But also, I want them to have feelings for these characters and to, we live in such a divisive time where people
Yeah.
are angry at one another, and essentially, that's a waste of energy. You can disagree with someone politically and still like that person. And by having all these various characters seeing the world in different ways, I would like the reader to understand that and to see, well, Rusty thinks Mrs. Laban's a jerk. Camilla loves her. That people are complex and multifaceted. And we shouldn't be just limited to our own egocentric perspective. We should take a broader view of humanity.
Yeah. You have another book in you?
I have one that's I'm finishing up. It's called Long Ago Last Summer. And it's a collection of stories, poems, and nonfiction dealing with the South. Southern Gothic is an underlying theme, but each piece can stand alone by itself. You can flip through like an anthology. But if you were to start at the beginning and go through the very end, it's sort of like a mosaic memoir of my life, growing up
Yeah.
in Somerville, going off to college, getting married, losing my wife, and then finding love again after that and remarrying. And so each little piece can stand alone, but it once again, if you read it from cover to cover, you get the overarching of my life.
When we only have a few minutes, but I'd like to get drilled down deep with you for a second, because Houston brings back memories for you, because your wife was here at MD Anderson,
Right.
right across the street. Have you ever written about what it was like to go through a wife of almost 40 years and losing her to cancer? Have you ever walked into that room to sit down and write specifically about what your emotions were with that experience?
Well, I publish a blog, so all during Judy's illness, I wrote about it
Oh, wow.
and the aftermath. But I will say that during this entire experience, we live from day to day, and even though the end was inevitable, right up until like a week before she died, we laughed. And so it was the MD Anderson experience was, I went, we sort of enjoyed it. You know, we got out of town, ate some great food. MD Anderson is the only hospital I know of that has a bar in it, a bar and a restaurant. And we met a former student who was living in town. And there's a wonderful story. We probably don't have time to tell it, but there's a woman in Houston named Judy Birdsong, which was my wife's name. And over the years, they'd gotten emails that were mixed up, that my Judy would get her Judy. And so they became sort of pen pal friends, email friends. And she met us in Houston and took us out to lunch, the two Judy Bird songs. And it was really special.
That's neat. That's neat. Wesley, again, I want to thank you for being with us. I want you to hold up the book one more time. Let everybody get one more chance to see this beautiful cover and to get this beautiful book, Today, Oh Boy, by Wesley Moore III. And it's easy on Amazon to do. And I got it on the Kindle and I read it right here on my phone. And it was a great way. I love, although I'd like, if it was me, I like the hard copy. I'm the old-fashioned guy. I like to go in and smell the pages. I like to pull it off a shelf and read it and dog-ear it and circle good things that I like to. That's me, but Kindle is the way to go sometimes when you need it fast. But get on Amazon and type in Today, Oh Boy by Wesley Moore III. Wesley, any other thoughts before we go tonight?
No, thank you very much. This has been excellent questions. I thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you, Greg.
Well,
Thank
thank you. If there's every time you want to come back on, you got that other book that you want to get out or whatever, just want to come and talk, we'd be love to have you on the program again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay. As we do each and every week, we always like to close the program. And I think this story that Wesley talked about his own personal life goes right along with this, that even though you think there's a time that, hey, this is going to be the darkest day of your life and you'll never recover from what you're going through, there is hope. There is, after a tragic loss, there is another day. And this book talks about that. And that's something that maybe we all need to just go into this week, understanding that you better enjoy the moment today because you're never guaranteed another. But I won't let you know. As long as there's breath in you, there's always hope. Thank you so much for joining us. With us today for Breaking the Silence. Be with us next week. You will not want to miss next week's program. God bless you. Have an awesome, awesome week. Good night. We'll see you.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1 for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.